Father, we thank you for Mark and for all that he is and who he is, for all that he's done, and for the blessing he is to us. And I pray for him this morning that you will speak to him and to him through him to us. In Jesus' name.
Amen. Yes, good morning. We have problems with heat and we have problems with sound, so I'll try and bring a little bit of light, but I can't guarantee anything. Not sure about the sound as well. Perhaps I can measure out the scarf, but if I get cold, I'll leave it up there. Yes, a few weeks ago, I was emailed by Louise, our faithful secretary, saying there was a bit of a gap in the schedule for preaching, and so could I sort of fill the slot? And I said, well, possibly, but could you give me some choice of subjects? Now, we've been following a series on Jesus, the life of Jesus, character of Jesus, ministry of Jesus, so what's left to cover? So Louise sent me three topics, all of which looked extremely challenging, and I chose one that I thought marginally sort of easier than the others, which is Jesus, Lord of History. Now, I don't want to imply that speaking to Network is a chore. It shouldn't ever be a chore. We should be privileged to share Jesus with our friends, all of us who speak. It's a great joy. It's a privilege. But Jesus, Lord of History, is, well, how long have I got? You know, it's a long period history. There's BC and there's AD, so 25 minutes is a little bit steep, isn't it? Where do you start? Well, I'm starting with what we call the incarnation. God became man. All Christian denominations agree on this. They may disagree on lots of other things, but whether you're Catholic or Protestant or Orthodox or evangelical, we believe that Jesus came from heaven as God. Now, it's not something that makes any sense if you simply rely on logic or reason or any sort of scientific understanding of the world. But it's there, isn't it? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh. In our hymns, think of Hark the Herald Angels Sing, veiled in flesh the Godhead see, hail the incarnate deity. Well, it's all there. Jesus had existence before he actually appeared on earth. Now, insofar as the people in the world sort of think about Jesus at all, they probably think about him in the context of a sort of a moral teacher, a religious leader, and then they sort of say, well, let's have a little exercise sort of comparing Jesus with, you know, Buddha or Confucius or Gandhi or somebody, and we'll sort of, you know, use a kind of tick box thing and see who comes out top of the class, so to speak, on that. Well, of course, it's a nonsense. If Jesus is the Son of God, if Jesus was with God from heaven, then any exercise really like that is a little bit meaningless. I use the phrase there, the Son of God. What does that mean? I did have a conversation with a member of Network a little bit, some time ago, who'd, I think, been talking to a Muslim. And the Muslim would say, well, if Jesus is the Son of God, it means that he can't be God because God would have been there before Jesus was. In other words, the Father must have existed before the Son. Well, again, that sounds logical. You tend to think, well, there ought to be a time when there was just a Father before you have a Son, if you think of any human terms. But again, in every good creed or statement of faith that has come down to us over the years, Jesus is described as being co-equal with God. He's not inferior. The Son isn't inferior to the Father, and co-eternal, if you can cope with those rather technical words. Again, the phrase that is used is Jesus is not a created being. Again, it's back in John, isn't it? Nothing was without him was not nothing made that was made, if you can remember that bit from the first chapter of John's Gospel. So although it defies logic, the Father and Son have been there from eternity and to eternity. So, in the Old Testament, of course, we get all the prophecies about the coming Messiah. Sometimes they're in rather vague terms. Sometimes it's a bit general as to exactly the nature of the Messiah or how he will appear. There's references to Bethlehem and then to Nazareth and then to Egypt. And you can think of the sort of theologians of that time sort of thinking, oh, well, where's he going to come from? You know, is it going to be there or there? They must have scratched their heads a little bit about that. But it's there all the way through the Old Testament, starting in the Garden of Eden. God says to the serpent, he says, concerning the woman's seed, the serpent will crush, start again, the serpent will bruise his heel, but he will crush your head. That was reference to the crucifixion. You know, Jesus was bruised, so to speak, at the crucifixion, but Satan was crushed. So that's in the third chapter of Genesis, and it carries on all the way through into the last book in the Old Testament, the book of Malachi. It says, suddenly the Lord whom you seek will come to the temple. So there he is, the prophecies of Jesus running all the way through Old Testament times. Jesus, Lord of history at that time. It's not just prophecies. There are a few rather strange events in the Old Testament where it seems that Jesus is appearing even before he was born on earth. Think of the book of Daniel, and the three young men are put into the fiery furnace, and they survive in the fiery furnace, and then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, is asked, so what do you see in that fiery furnace? And he says, there are four men in there, and one looks like the son of the gods. Well, there seem to be these few occasions in the Old Testament when Jesus sort of makes a rather interesting sort of appearance in that sort of way. So we think of Jesus born, as we've been celebrating, of course, over Christmas, and growing up, and his divinity, his divine nature then has to be sort of constrained a bit by his human nature. He's now limited, I suppose, by his being a human. He was fully human as well as being fully God. And you just wonder how his awareness of his nature sort of appeared. I mean, he had to grow up and sort of learn to walk and learn to talk and learn to think, and like any child, presumably. And the only glimpse we get, of course, is when he's about 12 years old and he gets lost on a trip to Jerusalem, and he is found in the temple, and he's trying to explain. The parents are rather angry with him and saying, well, where have you been all this time? And he says, well, didn't you know that I must be doing my father's business? And that was about the only glimpse we have of how his awareness arose. Now, he starts his ministry. We read about his baptism, of course, by John the Baptist, and then his temptation, the temptation in the wilderness. And he really starts his ministry with a little bit of a trip around Galilee, and his reputation gets known. And then we have this occasion when he goes into the synagogue at Nazareth. And I'll just read this bit. Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news of him spread through the whole countryside. He taught in their synagogues, and everyone praised him. So he had a bit of a reputation. He'd done a few things before this story that's coming. He went to Nazareth, where he'd been brought up, and on the Sabbath day he went into the synagogue, as was his custom, and he stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. Then he began by saying, Today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. Is this Joseph's son? They asked. Jesus said to them, surely you will quote this proverb to me. Physician, heal yourself. Do here in your hometown what we have heard you did in Capernaum. I tell you the truth, he continued. No prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you, there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet. Yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built, in order to throw him down a cliff. But he walked away through the crowd and went on his way. So he declares a sort of mission statement taken from the book of Isaiah. And people start off saying, oh, you know, that's an interesting young man here. Heard his gracious words. And then he says, well, I'm really revealing to you that I am a prophet and I have a prophet's ministry, but I'm not going to be accepted in this town. This little two-horse town of Nazareth isn't sort of big enough really for my ministry. And often, of course, in previous times, the prophets were rejected in their home countries. They were persecuted. And so he gives the example of Elijah, who could have found many widows, no doubt, in Israel, but was sent to a widow outside of Israel, in Sidon, at Zarephath. And then Elisha, no doubt, there were many people suffering from leprosy in Israel, but Elisha ministered to Naaman, who was a Syrian. And really he's saying that you're not going to receive my ministry, my ministry is going to be for other people or beyond this particular town. And of course, the moment they said that, their whole attitude changed. So within a few minutes, it seems 1 minute they're saying he's a really gracious man with interesting words, and the next minute they're trying to kill him and throw him off a cliff. And that seems to be really the story of Jesus' life and the story of much of what's been going on the last 2,000 years. There are many people are either for Jesus or against him. He doesn't allow very much sort of half measures, really, in that respect. Right. Now, what are we to make of the last 2,000 years of history? Well, there's been quite a lot of fairly traumatic experiences, hasn't it? Mankind has gone through famines and persecutions, genocides, earthquakes, hurricanes, goodness knows what. And people look at all the suffering that has happened throughout the world over these 2,000 years, and they quite naturally ask the question, where's God in all that? I think Christians sort of struggle over over that that situation. Where's Jesus been for the last 2,000 years? There used to be an advertisement that appeared in national newspapers, and I think it was put there by the Catholics, and it was a sort of typical sort of head and shoulders kind of picture of Jesus, you know, beard and long hair and so on, and it gave this little patter, which I suppose is quite familiar, a sort of evangelical kind of a little bit of apologetic and saying, Jesus, here's the man who never wrote a book, never led an army, never got involved in politics particularly, lived in some little obscure place in a small part of the Roman Empire, but 2,000 years later, there are 2.5 billion Christians, he's had more influence than all the politicians, all the preachers, all the generals, all the other leaders put together, really. It's a bit of a cliche almost, isn't it? That kind of analysis of how Jesus has been involved in the last 2,000 years. In fact, obviously, we know Jesus through his teaching. I've got one of those Bibles, a red letter Bible. You know those ones where all the words of Jesus are just in red, so you can sort of see what he actually said. And I actually just, over the last couple of weeks, I did a little exercise. I thought, I wonder how long it takes to read everything Jesus said, just the red letter bits. So I did it in sort of half-hour slots, and it takes just about 3 hours, just slightly over 3 hours. So everything he said can be read in 3 hours. And of course, a lot of those are repeats anyway, because they're the parables that come up in more than one gospel. So everything he said can be said in 3 hours. And when you think you sat how many sort of lectures and sermons you've sat through in that time, and without even a fraction of the wisdom and the power of what Jesus said. Anyway, coming back to looking at all the sort of sad history of the world, Christians must struggle, really, with trying to reconcile disasters and suffering with God's love. If God's omnipotent, why didn't he do something about it? But of course, worldly people will use this as a kind of cop-out, won't they? They will say, oh, I can't believe in God who lets this happen or lets that happen or allows this to happen. Oh, no, God like that is no good for me. You know, I need somebody better than that. They come out with a very arrogant sort of attitude here. I don't know if you've seen the film Philomena. Have you seen the film? It's sort of around. It's about this Irish lady who had a baby out of wedlock, and because of the atmosphere in Ireland, she was taken into this sort of abbey to be looked after, and then had the baby, and then the baby was forcibly adopted and was taken to America. And then 50 years on, she seeks the help of a journalist to go and track him down. Very good film, actually. Very worth seeing. But the journalist is played by... The lady is played by Judi Dench, who, of course, is brilliant. And the journalist by the Steve Coogan, the comedian, who's a bit near the knuckle sometimes. But he does a very good job in this film. Who's seen it? Who's seen it, by the way? Anyone? Oh, only one. Oh, didn't... She happens to live in St. Albans at the moment, yes. But anyway, Steve Coogan is the sort of hard-bitten, you know, worldly journalist who sort of has a rant every now and again against religion, you know, and all the moan about religion. Why did God let all that earthquake happen, all these people die, wherever it was at the time? And Philomena comes over as the little naive religious Irish lady. She's still keeping to her Roman Catholic faith, but the way the film is shown, she sort of is quite subtle, actually. She's got a little bit more to her than the journalist realizes, and she gets one over on him in a lot of arguments. Now, my point would be, if the non-Christian is going to say, well, I blame God for this and I blame God for that, you know, all the trouble that's happened over the last 2,000 years, I have a bit more respect if, they could either say, well, I don't believe in God at all, so in other words, the whole thing is meaningless, but if they're going to blame God for all the things that went wrong, they ought to, by the same logic, actually praise God for all the things that have gone right, you know, and when we start to think about it, and the fact the sun comes out and the plants grow and the rain falls so we can grow crops and we lead fairly comfortable lives, and if somebody got up in the morning and said, you know, I'm really praising God for all the blessings that I've received, then you'd have a bit more respect when they have a bit of a moan about all the things that go wrong. Excuse me if I just take a drink. Now, coming to slightly more recent history, where is God in all this? This is one of my favourite books. It's called God and Gold. Now, it's really a history of capitalism over the last sort of 350 years. Depends how you define capitalism, of course, but according to this historian, it's to do with how first the Dutch and then the British and then the Americans sort of gradually learned how to sort of handle money. Now, it's not a Christian book as such. It's not written by a Christian trying to sort of make a point. Whether the guy's a Christian or not, I'm not quite sure. But it's written, it's a history And then it's looking at the spiritual dynamic behind history. It's a nice hefty read, you know, it's 400 pages and it's by somebody who obviously is extremely intelligent guy. He's called Walter Russell Mead. Now, he's an American. He's involved in politics. I don't think he's an elected politician, but he knows an awful lot of history and he knows an awful lot about economics and politics and literature as well and religion. So he's obviously quite a bright guy. Now, he uses some very clever literary analogies to make his points. I mean, one thing that comes up quite clearly is he takes the story of the walrus and the carpenter from Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland. You all know the walrus and the carpenter? And they have this, the walrus and the carpenter have this, what seems like a completely nonsensical sort of conversation, you know, on the beach, and they're trying to sweep the beach to get rid of all the sand. And then you have this line which says, the walrus and the carpenter, the time has come, the walrus said, to talk of many things, of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings, and why the sea is boiling hot and whether pigs have wings, you see. And, of course, it's probably just meant to be nonsense, but this guy says, well, now, this is just like an international conference. It's like what's going on in Davos. Shoes, well, that's manufactured products. Ships, well, that's transport, you know, imports and exports. Cabbages, well, that's agriculture. And kings, well, that's all about regime change. And why the sea is boiling hot, well, that's obviously global warming. And then, whether pigs have wings is genetic engineering, you see. So he uses this sort of analogy. It's an interesting book. And basically, he regards Britain as the walrus and America as the carpenter, and they're always trying to sort of sweep up the beaches from sand and not getting very far, you know, because they can't have seven maids with seven mops swept it for half a year or however it goes. So they're always trying to solve all the world's problem, but they end up eating all the oysters, which is sort of world's resources, I suppose. You know? So it's done very cleverly. Anyway, you might think that as Christians we ought to be a little bit suspicious of capitalism, be a bit uncomfortable with the whole idea of capitalism after all that's been going on for the last few years. Jesus said, lay not up for yourself treasure on earth. Don't rely, you cannot serve God and mammon and all those sort of things. However, we have to face the fact that if you have a bank account and if you have savings or investments or you have a pension or something, you are involved in capitalism. The fact that things have to be financed and, you know, to build power stations or, you know, railways or whatever it might be, then this has to be financed, and that comes really through through capitalism. I mean, one of the interesting themes of the book really is that throughout the last sort of 200 or 300 years, it seems that the countries that have won the wars, which tended to be Britain most of the time, you know, into the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, and America then, it isn't so much that they had better armies, it's just that they had better way of handling money. So the countries that lost the wars lost them because they sort of ran out of money, including the Cold War, because the Russians sort of couldn't finance it anymore, so they gave up. And likewise with industrialization, it wasn't just much inventing a steam engine, you had to find the finance to actually sort of put in all the infrastructure, and that had to come from somewhere. Now, there are better historians than me, I'm sure, in here. I may be looking at certain people, you know, if they've got degrees in history or anything like that. But, of course, history isn't just events. It's not just one thing after another, as somebody once said. It isn't just, you know, how many wives did Henry VIII have, or who won this battle, or what was the date of Magna Carta. It's about sort of what is driving these processes, what is causing things to happen, what are the sort of basic kind of human forces, or more, maybe they're not human forces, that cause things to happen. Now, there was a Marxist theory of history, basically along the lines that sort of all historical movements was about the proletariat, the oppressed masses trying to overthrow the powerful, the bourgeoisie, the powerful people, the people with the money, the people, the aristocracy, or whatever it was. I don't know much about Marxism, you'll be glad to hear. But some years ago, there was a team from this church went out to the Ukraine, where there's a bit of trouble going on at the moment, another place we could pray for. We went to visit two churches, well, we went to visit two brothers who were both pastors of churches, lived in the same area. They both had very large families. One had 11 children, the other had 13. Lovely families they were. And we visited their churches, we stayed with them. I remember in one of the houses, I took down a book from the bookshelf of one of these men. And I think it was a children's history book. And I couldn't read it, of course, because it was in Russian or Ukrainian, but I could see from the pictures what it was all about. So this was obviously from the Marx, from the communist era, and there was pictures of Oliver Cromwell. So that was obviously the English Revolution. It was all about revolutions. Then there was the American War of Independence and overthrowing King George III, and then it was the French Revolution and this revolution and the Russian Revolution. So it was the Marxist line on history. How things... What's been driving history. The only thing was that we then went to visit one of these churches, and it was held in a school. So we went into a school hall, and I sort of was wandering about in this school hall, not a bit like this room here, you know. And I wandered to the back, and I sort of looked out into the schoolyard behind, and there was this pile of rubbish, you know, the stuff that was going to be chucked out. And of course, sitting on top of this pile of rubbish was a picture of Lenin that's been dumped from the school equipment. In fact, I even took a photograph of the picture of Lenin. Not a very good picture, I'm afraid, but you can just about see the picture of Lenin. So I thought that rather summed up the Marxist view on history. It wasn't quite working out exactly as intended. Now, the very interesting idea in this book, really, is that what's driving history, or what's for quite a long time, but certainly over the period this guy covers, is what he calls the Abrahamic narrative. Now, what on earth does he mean by the Abrahamic narrative? I can't think that the capitalists in the City of London or on Wall Street think very much about Abraham in their day-to-day work. But his view was that non-Christian religions often tend to believe in sort of reincarnation. So life sort of goes in a circle. You know, you live your life and you die and then you come back as somebody else or something else. And things sort of go round and round in circles. So nothing very much changes. So for long periods, of course, certain civilizations have just sort of potted along, really, without anything really changing very much. But the thing about Abraham was this. First of all, he was told to leave the city where he was born and to move out. So there was the narrative of movement from Ur to Canaan. That was part of Abraham's life. Then he was told that his descendants would be like the sand of the sea. There would be multiplication, there would be growth. And however improbable it seemed at the time, when of course he didn't have a son for a long time, that is what happened about. That's what happened eventually. And thirdly, of course, he was told that in his seed would all the nations of the earth be blessed. And that meant was prophetic of Jesus. It wasn't his seeds generally, as Paul explains in one of the epistles. It was his individual seed, Jesus, who was blessed the nations. And finally, of course, he was a man of faith. It is said that he believed God and it was accounted to him for righteousness. So sort of driving history, if you follow what I've been reading here, is this desire for movement, for progress, for change, really. And of course, some people aren't comfortable with change, but other people are. So I suppose, thinking of the last 350 years, you have sort of people moving. I suppose there were the European empires. Now, I'm sure a lot of things went wrong and weren't particularly righteous about those, but there were people moving from Britain, say, originally to America and then to Australia, and then you had the Americans, you had the settlers sort of moving further and further west, you know, so there was always this sort of drive to move on to the next thing, not just sort of stick in one place. So, Jesus said, how is Jesus Lord of history? Well, he said, firstly, I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So we do see how, whatever the state of the church in this country or any other individual country, the church has been growing across the world, in Asia, in South America, in Africa. But of course, in this text, passage we read originally, which I've now lost, it explained how part of Jesus' ministry, of course, was to, as in the prophecy of Isaiah, to relieve the oppressed, to improve people's lots, to heal the blind, and to release the captives. So, of course, obviously, capitalism, whatever you think of it, has done a lot to, you know, produce the sort of things we enjoy today, to produce, clean water supplies and electricity and new medicines and food and everything. So Jesus has this, is Lord of his church, but he is also Lord of trying to relieve the suffering around the world. Yes, we've prayed already this morning for places where there is oppression, where there is persecution. I'm old enough to remember Chairman Mao and the Red Guards and Cultural Revolution, millions and millions of Red Guards all sort of going up and down, waving their little red book of Mao's sayings. And at that time, in the 60s, you sort of think, now, where on earth is the church in all this? You know, I mean, it looked like it had been completely squashed, you know, but of course, in due time, we find that, you know, there's millions of Christians in China. It's growing in China and has been all the time, even when the communists were in control. I had a very dear friend who was a Henry Guinness, who was a missionary in China before the last war, and he lived long enough to be able to go back to China and meet some of the people that he ministered to at that time. God moves in mysterious ways sometimes. We prayed earlier for North Korea, one of the places where there's still persecution, oppression. But in South Korea, as you know, I'm sure, there's a growing, very vigorous church, a new church. It's the first missionaries only arrived in China apparently in 1865. This, 150 years now, isn't it? Now, last summer I visited Wales because, as well as the website I have for English Christian Heritage, I'm trying to put one together for Welsh Christians. Who were they and where do they live and what can we learn about them and what places are there that you can visit? Now, there's a little village in Wales called Llanover. It's about just south of Abergavenny. As in most Welsh villages, there's a little stone chapel, most of which looked a bit sort of shut up and boring, and some of them sort of not used as chapels anymore, but this one still functions. And you get sort of coach loads of Korean Christians coming to visit this chapel, you know, and you think, well, what are they doing here? It all goes back to somebody called Robert Germain Thomas, who I'm sure you've never heard of. But Robert Germain Thomas was the first Christian missionary to Korea. So they're coming back to sort of pay tribute to him. And the only thing was, his career as a missionary in Korea lasted about 10 minutes because he sort of stepped ashore from a boat and was sort of done to death in the mud, sort of on the shoreline. He'd gone to China and he And he'd found that maybe Koreans he found that Koreans, educated Koreans, could read Chinese. So he acquired a great sort of stock of Chinese Bibles and sort of got on an American trading ship. Unfortunately, the trading ship, the Koreans didn't really want the trading ship, and so there was a bit of a battle going on, and it sailed up a river, and they were sort of firing at each other, I think. It was all a bit of a shambles. But he ended up sort of stumbling ashore from this river and handing out Bibles to anybody who was around before somebody sort of finished him off. But apparently the Bibles got into the hands of people who could read them. And one story is that somebody sort of rather took a fancy to the paper, and it would be rather nice to paper the wall of their house with these pages in the Bible. People came along and sort of started reading. Anyway, that is one of the things that started the church in Korea. So God moves in many ways in history. So the question really that I will simply leave you with is Jesus Lord of your history? Or in what ways is Jesus Lord of your history? And you can think about that in your cell groups this week. So thank you.